The Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Bratfold, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Louise Dovery Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Thursday, January 21st, 2021. The first matter on our calendar for oral argument is the case of Tate versus the State of Minnesota. While we are conducting these hearings by Zoom video conference, the same rules of appellate argument apply. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes to make your argument. Respondents counsel will have the same, and Mr. Longstorff, you will have an opportunity for rebuttal should you choose to use it. It's important that you both state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your arguments. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Zach Longstorff. I represent appellant DeAndre Tate. The primary issue before the court from my client's perspective is whether the district court erred in concluding that Mr. Tate's underlying ineffective assistance of counsel claim lacked merit. It's Mr. Tate's contention that the district court erred in its conclusion because there was no good cause ever offered by the prosecution for its failure to comply with the timing in writing requirements of Rule 7.03, and that Mr. Tate was prejudiced under the circumstances because an objection by counsel to the lack of good cause would have limited the length of the sentence he could have received to the guideline sentence of 206 months instead of the 309 month sentence that he did actually get. Now, in reversing and remanding this case back in 2019, this court stated, if, as Mr. Tate alleges, the state did not argue and could not show good cause, then it was outside the objective standard of reasonableness for counsel to fail to object.
Well, Mr. Longstorff, let me ask you this. In the absence of an objection, which we know there was no objection to the failure to give written notice a week before the omnibus hearing, in the absence of an objection, why would the court have ever been considering good cause or have made an express finding to that effect?
Well, I think it's, well, the reason is because there's two parts to Rule 7.03 to have untimely or oral notice given. And so I think that there were two parts, which are good cause and then on conditions that don't prejudice the defendant. So I think that it would have been appropriate to address those at the time. And the way Mr. Tate has raised his claim was that his trial counsel was ineffective for not making the proper objection at the time. And had trial counsel at the time made that objection, because there was no good cause, the district court would have to sustain it, which I think is what this court noted back in 2019. And therefore, Mr. Tate's sentence would have been restricted to 206 months. And I'd note that we then had an evidentiary hearing on this case. And the only thing that's ever been offered was the statement that the prosecutor made at the time that she had it on her calendar that to give the notice or to do amendments, and then the time came and went and she didn't really do it. So I think
Mr. Longstorff, let me ask you this. What can you point to in this record that suggests the district court would, back in 2014, would have likely denied the state's request to seek an aggravated sentence based on the prosecutor's failure to give the written notice 1 week before the December 2013 omnibus hearing?
Well, what I can point to in the record is that once this case went up on appeal, the Court of Appeals reversed and remanded, stating that if there isn't good cause, the district court would have to sustain it. And in this case, the only thing that was ever offered was that statement by the prosecutor, which was, I could have filed amendments, you know, a month ago, but I did have on my calendar that we had a deadline date and the date had passed. And I believe that Mr. Lewis and I corresponded and Mr. Lewis indicated he anticipated it would be a trial. And so that's the only thing that was ever offered by way of good cause. And so had that objection been made, then I think it would have to be sustained. And that leads kind of into the only case that we were able to identify that effectively addressed the good cause requirement under Rule 7.03 was this case called State v. Huber, which was cited in Mr. Tate's brief. And it was an unpublished case decided by this court back in May 11th of 2020. And I understand it's an unpublished case, but I think it's really the only case on point here. And what happened there was the district court, or excuse me, the Court of Appeals was analyzing good cause and noticed that there's no definition for it in the rules of criminal procedure. And therefore the court looked at just a standard legal dictionary definition. And what it settled on was, quote, a legally sufficient reason is how it would define good cause. And in that Huber case, there was essentially five reasons that the court found that there was good cause for the state's failure to give notice prior to the omnibus hearing. And that was the defendant had unexpectedly pled guilty at the Rule 8 hearing, that at the Rule 8 hearing, the prosecutor assigned to the case was absent, that the prosecution didn't have all the BCA records at the time of the Rule 8 hearing, and that the prosecutor assigned to the case had had a serious, I think they call it a serious personal matter to attend to, that kept him or her out of the office for several weeks. And then when the prosecutor returned, they were able to give notice very shortly after that. And so this court decided that that constituted a legally sufficient reason for the state failing to meet the timing requirement of Rule 7.03, where the written notice was given a week after, or not a week, but was given after the defendant unexpectedly pled guilty at the Rule 8 hearing. On the other hand, in this case, what we have offered as the legally sufficient reason for failing to meet Rule 7.03 was that quote I gave you just a moment ago about the prosecutor stating that she had it on her calendar and she knew the date had passed and she talked to Mr. Tate, but then didn't file anything to seek an aggravated sentence.
So she made a mistake. So in short, the record was, it was an oversight on the part of the prosecutor, because in fact, there had been the discussions and the oral notice given in December of 2013, correct?
Well, I don't dispute that that Mr. Tate's counsel said that that notice had, or that an aggravated sentence had previously been mentioned. But what I would note about the record is that there's no hearing transcript from December 18th that anybody could ever point to.
But it's not, Mr. Longstorff, I don't see it as being disputed. The district court, I mean, this is the kind of case you remember, right? A shooting involving a four-year-old and other children or another child present. I mean, this court remembered the topic of an aggravated sentence being discussed during the omnibus hearing in December of 13th. And I think both counsel agreed with that, didn't they? So isn't that our record that it was in fact discussed in, you know, orally at the omnibus hearing?
Well, that's not how I read what happened on March 18th of 2014. I mean, that's not how I understood the record, was that they had actually talked about it in front of the court, because what Mr. Tate's counsel mentioned was, he said that, you know, that the aggravated sentence had been mentioned and maybe in an email, but then when the prosecutor went ahead and brought up what the aggravating factors would be, I think the way that the district court responded, which was saying, wait a minute, what were those, is an indication that it hadn't been talked about on the record previously. And so I don't think the record supports that conclusion that it had been brought up previously. And the other part of that is that there's nothing about what happened on March 18th of 2014 to give any indication that Mr. Tate had ever been spoken to about what was mentioned previously about the aggravating factors and the possibility that the state would seek that kind of sentence. And I do think Mr. Tate's testimony at the evidentiary hearing kind of bore that out, that he said, you know, whatever happened with counsel, I was never told about it. And the first I heard anything about aggravating sentences was when I showed up that morning for jury selection. And so if we look at, but going back to this legally sufficient reason, now the March 19th Court of Appeals opinion reversing and remanding this case, I think laid out the prejudice to Mr. Tate under those circumstances pretty clearly. It stated, taking Tate's allegations as true, the district court would have to sustain an objection because the state could not meet the burden for late notice.
I'm going to interrupt you there because I have a question about that specific part of the opinion. Part of what makes this interesting is we are looking at some of the same arguments that were previously presented to the Court of Appeals. And for the Court of Appeals to have concluded that if these allegations are true, there would be prejudice because there was no finding of good cause, I think that affects what the focus and the scope was of the hearing that was then held. So in your opinion, what do you think the point of that hearing was?
So the point of the hearing was, I think, was an opportunity for Mr. Tate to prove what he had alleged in his earlier petition for post-conviction relief, which was that there had never been anything even close to good cause offered. And therefore, if that objection had been made, then he would have gotten relief. And the way
so
the
in other words, was, in other words, this court remands it for the purpose of deciding whether the trial court would have found good cause.
I think that's true as well. And then the other part of the Court of Appeals opinion had to do with whether or not appellate counsel had considered the issue properly and therefore it was unreasonable to raise it. And I guess our position on that is that we had this evidentiary hearing. I think the facts all came in basically essentially as Mr. Tate had alleged them in his brief. There was never anything offered by way of good cause. And then when the district court went ahead and did its analysis, the good cause, I think, came up three times total in its order. Once was a quote from appellate counsel, and then the other two times were just, as the court said, well, it's pretty routinely found. But I think what was lacking there was essentially this kind of analysis like happened in the Huber case, where we see if what was offered was actually a legally sufficient reason. And the way that we're looking at this is, I didn't read this as it was just a mistake that it wasn't done. I read it as the prosecutor had it on her calendar. She could have done it, knew what the rule meant, and didn't, essentially because they didn't feel like the rule was going to apply and it wasn't going to be a bar to seeking an aggravated sentence anyway.
So, well, I'm so not I sure guess Longstorff, how you get to that position, but I guess I would move to the next point, and that is, even assuming that you're right and that our court in 2019 essentially said, you know, we're saying in the absence of any evidence of good cause that trial counsel was ineffective. I mean, the next layer to find ineffective assistance of appellate counsel is to take the next step and say, this was clearly a meritorious claim and that, you know, appellate counsel was not, you know, did not provide reasonably competent representation. Why doesn't the testimony of the appellate lawyer, or I mean, at this point, doesn't the testimony of the appellate lawyer at the evidentiary hearing make a difference?
Well, I think it does. I mean, she did testify that she considered the notice claim and decided essentially that Mr. Tate wouldn't be able to satisfy the prejudice prong of the claim. And that's why she didn't raise it. But I do also think that she at least acknowledged that it was something that the Court of Appeals viewed as a viable claim, such that if she had raised it, Mr. Tate would have been able to get relief. And our position on that is if this is a claim, as Mr. Tate has alleged, and then there's no good cause, and if there's no good cause, an objection has to be sustained, then it was unreasonable not to raise it because Mr. Tate was prejudiced by at least 103 months when he got that much time more than the top of the box guideline sentence. And so our position
Mr.
is
Longstorff,
that if there
again,
was a claim.
I want to get back to the last Court of Appeals decision because I'm looking at what is the difference between what was presented to that court and what's presented to our court. And if what was presented to that court, these arguments about prejudice and what the attorneys actually knew versus what was formally written down. And in terms of this prejudice piece or in terms of appellate counsel, it looks to me as I read the appellate lawyer's testimony, that she just didn't expect the Court of Appeals to view this case the way that they did. And the Court of Appeals looked at it and said, there's going to be prejudice because that evidentiary, that objection would have been sustained. And I think that that's the piece that she didn't expect, because if you look at her testimony, her belief was that the district court would have found good cause on what had been presented, but there's, and this Court of Appeals went the other way. So again, I'm trying to line up what was presented to the Court of Appeals before and what's presented now. And it seems like the Court of Appeals already decided that if the record lacked sufficient evidence of good cause, there would have been enough prejudice to find that appellate counsel ineffective. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do agree with that. And the way I recall the appellate attorney's testimony was basically what you said is that she considered, and I don't think she focused as much on good cause as she, you know, turned her focus on the idea of prejudice. And she thought if I raise this, how do I show prejudice? And I can't show enough prejudice because she focused on the factual nature of the aggravating factors, whereas on a remand, this court said, you know, there would be the prejudice. And so I think what happened at the evidentiary hearing was part of it was, you know, Mr. Tate provided testimony to show that he didn't know about this, so he couldn't have raised it at an earlier time, which was part of overcoming the procedural bar that could have applied to the appellate counsel claim. And then the other part was just showing who knew what and what Mr. Tate knew, which was essentially nothing. But ultimately, what didn't change was that there was never anything offered by way of good cause. And if we're going to accept this as a legally sufficient reason, then the rule probably shouldn't have a good cause requirement in it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Longstarf. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Mr. Rood, you may present argument on behalf of the state.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jordan Rood, and I represent the respondent in this case, the state of Minnesota. I'm just going to start by addressing Judge Bryan's question about the purpose of the evidentiary hearing. Obviously, this was remanded from this court to address the claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. And the point of the hearing was to determine whether appellate counsel discussed this issue with appellant and what steps were taken in terms of either considering or not considering this claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. And I think appellate counsel's testimony is pretty clear that she discussed the issue because appellant brought it up with her. She discussed it with him. She reviewed the record. I think she even testified that she spoke to a supervisor, and she determined based on the record that she didn't think she could meet both prongs of the Strickland test in raising this issue. She did not believe it was meritorious
Was that based on the performance of counsel or the lack of prejudice?
I believe that was based on the lack of prejudice. Appellate counsel focused on the fact that the notice had been given. It was not written, but oral notice had been given. Most likely in December, but certainly prior to trial, and on the fact that the grounds that were being relied upon by the state were fact-based, or were essentially part of the facts of the offense. And so it's not something additional that appellant and his lawyer would need to prepare for or to address prior to trial. So I think those two factors were why appellant counsel determined that there wasn't a prejudice to appellant in this case, because he had been aware of it. And it wasn't something.
Again, I'm struggling with what the Court of Appeals said last time, and it seems to me when it comes to the prejudice part of this analysis that the district court found if there's no good cause, or the Court of Appeals said that if the district court would have found no good cause, then the prejudice is obvious. The upper departure would not have been allowed, and the longest sentence possible would have been the high end of the box. So it goes back to good cause. The prejudice is obvious because it affects the sentence. So then it goes back to good cause. And on that point, this court said that if, as Tate alleges, the state did not argue and could not show good cause, then it was outside the objective standard of reasonableness for counsel to fail to object. In other words, it seems to me that this court has already decided, absent evidence of good cause, there is that both prongs have already been met. The prejudice is obvious because of the sentence change. And if there's no good cause, then you would expect a reasonable counsel to object. So what is it that is left for the district court to do on remand if this court has already decided that absent good cause, that's outside of the objective standard, and because of the change in the sentence, there's prejudice? What's left for the district court then at that point?
Well, I think there are two answers to that. The first goes to a point that I think Judge Bjorkman made. that there wasn't, there is really no discussion of good cause in the record, certainly at the time that all this was happening in March 2014, because in part because there was no objection, and so there was not really a reason for the state to offer good cause at that point. But I think that this leads into the case that I cited in my brief, State v. Harrison, which is, again, a non-presidential opinion from this court. But I think it's very factually similar. It included untimely Blakely notice.
Right. And, but I'm not getting, I just don't want to know what was it that the district court was supposed to do. And given that this court of appeals, in my view, already concluded failing to object in the absence of some argument of good cause would be outside the reasonable standard, and already concluded that that would be prejudicial because of the change in the sentence. What seems to me to be left for the district court, it seems like that this court remanded for one purpose only, and that was to allow the parties to present evidence about good cause and let the district court then make a finding about whether, presented with that evidence, the trial court previously would have found good cause. That seems to be the sole point of this hearing.
Well, I think there were a couple other purposes for this hearing. One was to determine whether this appellate counsel claim may have been NAFLA barred, which I think Mr. Longsdorf might have mentioned briefly, which is the purpose of determining when did appellant know of this claim? Did he address it with appellant counsel? And could that potentially have been a procedural issue? And I think the record sort of forecloses that. But I think the other purpose was to determine appellate counsel's thought process or her view of this issue. You know, the record at that point didn't indicate had appellate counsel considered this issue. You know, did she look into it? What was her reason for not raising, or did she even not consider raising it? So I think that those were all purposes of this hearing, and it's true, neither the trial prosecutor nor appellant's trial counsel were called to testify. There wasn't any testimony about good cause, but I think that these other issues were also a purpose for that hearing and were addressed at that hearing. To go back to the good cause issue, I think that leads into the Steve Harrison case, in the fact that in that case, this court held that the district court had implicitly found good cause in the way that the issue was discussed in the record. I think that's very similar to what happened in this case. In this case, the district court was clearly aware that this was being brought up the day or the day before trial, and asked, you know, this has been brought up before, right? And asked, do you think there's any prejudice to appellant's counsel? Appellant counsel said, no, I don't think there's any prejudice. So I think that this, the district court was certainly aware, and I think there was even a break where the parties reviewed Rule 703 and the district court may have reviewed it as well. So this is not something that, you know, was sort of brushed aside. There was a discussion about it, you know, it may have been brief. But so I think that is a very similar situation to the one in Harrison, where this court found that the district court had implicitly found good cause in a way that the matter was addressed.
Well, but Harrison involved an actual objection at the time in the district court. So there wasn't a good cause finding, but there was a finding by the district court that there was no prejudice. So I can see how you can imply the good cause, but why can we do so in this case?
So I think in this case, it comes from, I think there's the district court asked more or less straightforwardly, you know, to appellant's counsel, do you think that you've been prejudiced by this lack of notice as part of this discussion? Looking at the transcript to see if I can find that. I believe it's in either page 3 or 4 of the trial transcript. I apologize for not being able to find that. But I think that the district court more or less asked, you know, are you saying that there's any prejudice? And appellant's counsel said no. And so I think that combined with, you know, the lack of a discussion of good cause and the sort of in the way that the trial moved forward, that this combines to an implicit finding that there is good cause because it had been brought up before, defense counsel was aware of it, and again, these were fact-based aggravated factors that didn't require any sort of special preparation. unless there are any other questions.
So, counsel, let me ask you a question about your last argument. So it seems to me that what you're doing is blending the good cause with prejudice. And obviously there are two different steps in the rule, but both of them are fact-based determinations. One falls to the prosecutor, right? To establish good cause. In this case, it fell to the prosecutor under this particular rule for notice to establish good cause. So the fact that I guess what I'm struggling with is the fact that the defense counsel acknowledged no prejudice because of the informal notice isn't really the same as the state establishing good cause, right?
I would agree with that.
Okay. So given we're confronting that, if you'd help me understand how we're supposed to analyze the purpose of the evidentiary hearing in light of appellant's claim, ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. So say we assume that there is good cause, there was not good cause, and there was prejudice, right? So where do we go from there?
I think from there, it was sort of a twofold question. Again, the procedural issue, which I think was brought up by this court in that prior opinion, you know, should appellant have raised this claim earlier, which was addressed by his testimony regarding when he learned of the issue, what he was aware of in terms of the rules. And then the second part is, was a testimony regarding appellant counsel's performance. You know, did she consider this claim? Did she intend to address it, or did she never even consider addressing it? So I think that those two different steps that were the purpose of that hearing were determined to get more evidence in the record about why the claim wasn't raised and should it have been raised earlier.
All right. And obviously we have our testimony from appellant's counsel at the evidentiary hearing. So in light of that, you know, how do we sustain the district court's determination in this case to deny post-conviction relief?
The testimony that was provided by appellate counsel is, I think, pretty clear that she did consider this issue, and in her view, it was not meritorious. And she based it on her experience as an appellate lawyer, her experience arguing before this court, and her review of the record. And that's, you know, based on, there's, I think one of the judges today noted there's several different layers of prejudice here. There's the, you know, the Rule 703 prejudice, there's the trial counsel prejudice and the appellate counsel prejudice. And I think appellate counsel's testimony was looking at all of this together, considering, you know, what's the purpose of Rule 703 and was it substantially complied with in this case? You know, sort of going through all those layers, there wasn't enough to establish the prejudice that's required under Strickland. And I think that also goes to a point that was made by the district court in its order that there isn't really any case law that requires a strict adherence with Rule 703. And I think that's sort of reflected in Harrison, which, you know, and I think there are some other cases that, you know, had untimely notices, but that wasn't, you know, that's not a requirement that the case automatically be reversed or that there's automatically relief because of that fact. And if there's nothing further,
well, I'll jump in because I think as you were answering Judge Bratpohl's questions, that is exactly where I'm looking at too. I want to know what was it that the appellate counsel said about her thought process, and There is a lot of what she testified to is quoted in the briefs, and I went back and read some of the transcripts. So this is a quote from when the court is zeroing in on that issue as well. And it seems to me that appellate counsel was also kind of conflating the issue of written notice versus oral notice with good cause. So the district court asks her, why did you feel that would not be prejudicial? And appellate counsel says, as I read the rule, it looked as though this was more of a form rather than functionality. And she's talking about written versus oral notice. So what I saw, and what I saw the judge do on the record as well, is look at, was there actual harm to this defendant? Did he know about the upper departure? And again, so she's talking about notice, not good cause for the delay or the late notice. And then she says, there's an ability for the court to find that if there was good cause shown, that strict written standard doesn't need to be followed. And I felt that on the record that I had, I didn't have enough to show that strict adherence would have been required. But there is an 80s discussion of what it is that she's looking at in her, what she calls the record, to lead her to that conclusion. And so that's to me where this hinges. So maybe you can explain what in the record below addresses why she wouldn't have enough to show that strict adherence would have been required. In other words, why was there good cause? And what in the evidentiary hearing addresses that? Because I think that's as close as she gets without explaining what it is she's looking at.
And I'll just, I see my time's out, but if I can't answer the question, I think, you know, you're right that there is, you know, there's very little discussion in the record in total, including this evidentiary hearing, of good cause. And I think what appellant counsel stated a few things that she was looking at, you know, the fact that oral notice had been given earlier, the fact that the factors were sort of fact-based, and so in you know, those don't directly address this good cause issue, but I think that it's looking at those factors in the context of the fact that this discussion was had on the record. The district court was aware that written notice had not been given, that, you know, certainly wasn't timely, but then the issue was addressed, and then the trial proceeded with the aggravated factors being allowed to be admitted. So I think those, in addition to the other parts of it, were what the appellant counsel was reviewing when she made that determination. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Longstorff, you have the last word.
Thank you. I just want to touch on this, this idea that because appellate counsel decided that she couldn't prove prejudice, that she couldn't go forward with the claim, or that it wouldn't be viable. I mean, the standard is, at least as written in the 2019 opinion in this case, it says appellate counsel is not required to raise all possible claims on appeal, and a claim need not be raised if appellate counsel could have legitimately concluded that it would not prevail. And I know that appellate counsel concluded that it wouldn't prevail after her analysis, but I think that the Court of Appeals opinion really pushed down on that and showed that that probably wasn't a legitimate conclusion for appellate counsel to have reached based on the facts that were in this case. And then I just do want to touch on this idea that the Harrison case that opposing counsel discussed would dictate the outcome.
So counsel, let me just stop you for a second and hold on to your second thought, because I'm sure we want to hear it. So you're saying that, as I hear you, and maybe I misunderstand you, that our court rejected in the opinion previously leading to the remand, that our court rejected the idea that this was an issue and that would not have prevailed. But we did that without having accepting the allegations made in the post-conviction petition as true, and without having heard any evidence from appellate counsel, right? That was the purpose of the remand, wasn't it?
I think that was part of the purpose of the remand. And I think the way it was remanded was, if what Mr. Tate alleges is true, then he would get relief. And I think the way the testimony came in was that she talked about the fact that she considered it, looked at it, and thought that he couldn't show that there would be prejudice. But I also think that she agreed, as part of her testimony, that when the Court of Appeals took a look at it in 2019, they viewed it as a viable claim. And I don't think that there's really any circumstance where leaving a viable claim on the table would be a reasonable thing to do or reasonable for counsel.
I guess what I'm trying to ask you is it's not enough for us to rely on what the Court of Appeals found in, let's call it, you know, Tate 2, all right, and this is Tate 3. It's not enough for us to rely on it. We do have to go to the evidence that was offered at the evidentiary hearing and review our post, our last district court decision for abuse of discretion, right?
I do think so. And okay. I think what happened at that hearing was counsel explained the kind of how she looked at it. And as it was sort of talked about earlier, she looked at it strictly under the terms of prejudice, sort of blending that with good cause. And so I don't think there's anything to indicate she seriously considered a good cause objection. And also, I do think that her testimony, I don't think she said it outright, but I think she agreed with a question that was something along the lines of, the Court of Appeals looked at this opinion, viewed this as a claim that would have been meritorious, right? And she agreed with that. So I do think that there's enough evidence in the record to show that appellate counsel, even though she concluded it wouldn't be successful, that she didn't do so legitimately. And then I do just want to touch on the Harrison case, and the way that case actually went is quite a bit different from our case. So what happened there was that the defendant didn't get timely notice, but he did get written notice about a week after the omnibus hearing. And it was actually before the defendant had entered a plea. It was a month before he went to trial, and it was at a time such that there was actually a contested hearing held on the aggravating factors before the defendant went to trial. And I think that's in real stark contrast to this case, which is Mr. Tate testified the first he heard about this was that morning when they were picking the jury. Oral notice was given that day. There wasn't any opportunity for a contested hearing after that. And in fact, there wasn't even hardly time for Mr. Tate to do anything after that, because the jury was, I think, probably in the elevator coming up for jury selection. And then they talked about it for a little bit. The district court sort of ended it by saying, hey, take a look at the rule and get back to me if something's up. And then they picked a jury and started trial the next morning. And so if we look at that case, we can see that Mr. Tate's case is quite far away from that in the notice that was given and in what that notice allowed Mr. Tate to do. And I think that it's far enough away from Tate's case or from Harrison and closer to, for example, the Huffman case that the district court cited where no notice was given, that it would be appropriate to reverse and remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Longstorff. Thanks to both of you for your helpful arguments. The case was well presented. We appreciate that. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. We will now recess in preparation for the 10:20 oral argument. Thank you, counsel.